This is React Podcast. I'm Chantastic. Hello, React Podcast listeners, and Happy New Year. I apologize for the longer than expected break, but I needed it. We're kicking off the new decade by going back in time to 1999, just 10 years after the birth of the internet. Our guest today is Lee Byron. He takes us on a tour of the early web and personal home pages and connects the dots between PHP and technologies like React and GraphQL. His work inside Facebook during a critical pivot to mobile provides a unique vantage point on the progress of web technologies over the past 20 years. Before we dive in, I want to tell you about a project I'm kicking off in 2020. I've taught thousands of React developers how to build React apps. And what I've found is that the biggest challenge developers face isn't inside React itself, it's in JavaScript. Everyone overestimates their own abilities in JavaScript. Now, you could dedicate your entire life to mastering JavaScript. There's just too much to learn there. I just want to show you five frequently overlooked JavaScript features that are critical for effective React development. If you want to learn what they are, just visit jsandreact.com. When you sign up, you'll get a weekly email covering all five of these critical JavaScript features that most React developers miss. I hope to see you there. Now, into the show. Lee Byron, welcome back to React Podcast.
Oh, thank you.
You've actually been on like many iterations of this podcast. I think that we had, like, before it was rebooted with Michael Jackson, you were on and we talked about Doctor Who and bow ties.
Yes. Yeah. The origin of the bow tie. Yeah,
I feel like that
it's my favorite doctor, for sure, the Bowtie Doctor.
I feel like that might have gotten lost to the internet. I hope that I can find it. I'll put it on SoundCloud or something so we can all enjoy it again. But
that's true.
But a lot's happened since then. But first, you gave a great talk today. And it's kind of hard to put like what exactly it's about because it kind of intersects like PHP and like the early internet and like React and all that kind of stuff. But it was great. Like, give me like a, from your perspective, what it was about.
Yeah. This is a talk where I have multiple slides where I say today we're going to talk about, and I like just then completely change the topic of the talk. So it's a little sporadic in that way. I think my like short sum up of it, it's my love letter to PHP. I feel like PHP gets a lot of hate, and there's plenty to hate. I mean, it's a quirky language for sure. And the standard library is like totally inconsistent. Yeah. We can all complain about PHP. But PHP was also kind of amazing. Like,
yes.
It showed up at a time when the web was in its infancy and was still kind of more like a project for nerds like us to do cool stuff on, to like show each other that we could do cool stuff, and not quite yet a thing that like businesses are building on top of. And PHP showed up at that moment, and it kind of like, it was the first language built for the web, and it just, it kind of set the stage. Like it framed up the mental model for how we've done everything ever since then. And I don't know, I feel like I get two kinds of reactions from this talk. For people who are my age, you know, if they're over 30, then it's thanks for the nostalgia trip. I remember like the dial-up modem, and oh, I remember learning CSS 1, and like I remember like the Lynx browser or like when Firefox first came out, and this whole just like, it was a little bit of a, you know, nostalgia trip through all of these like things that we had gone through as a really early web developer community. And then the completely opposite reaction I get from people who are, you know, younger or newer to the industry. And there it's like, hey, I learned React in college. I graduated. I got a job doing React. And like, I never stopped to think, where'd this stuff come from? They just kind of assume that, oh, there's some smart person who figured out React. And then like, now we all use it. Like, no, it's like each step you can only understand each step with the context of what was happening in that moment. And so, you know, I kind of wanted to unwind a little bit and talk, yes. start all the way back 20 years ago. What were the original tools like? And then just, you know, I spent 10 years at Facebook, and Facebook used PHP, and Facebook started with the LAMP stack and MySQL. And it very much started in exactly that set of tools. And so I kind of got to have a front row seat for this technology evolution of like, bump into a problem. What are we going to do? Here's a crazy thing that might work. Oh, kind of works. Cool. What can we learn from that? All right. Here's the next problem we bump into. And like, when I was in it and like seeing it, I didn't really appreciate what pieces were kind of incremental, what pieces were huge leap forwards, yep. what pieces were actually just taking a 20-year-old idea and yes. reapplying it. And only kind of now, with the benefit of hindsight, have I been able to kind of stitch together a story for how all of these things are interconnected and help kind of understand why we build stuff the way we build today. So it was really fun to assemble a talk. I feel like I'll never assemble something quite as like nice as this one. It's like little bites of everything that I've done in the last 10 years.
Yeah, it really does have that personal touch where it feels. You were there, right? And so this is your story. And like, you were like at the beginning of kind of what people were doing with PHP and trying to like make these like social networks and like, you know, what we were figuring out about the internet and social. But then also to like now like React, and we're like figuring out all of like how we make it fast, how we make it accessible, how we like take it to the masses. And like that transition started with PHP, which is wild.
Yeah, and along the way, you know, we've made much cooler things. Like,
sure.
If you think about the apps that we were building in the 1999 or the early 2000s, like, I remember when Flickr came out, and it's like, blew our minds, right? You can put photos on the internet, and like, it felt super smooth and dialed in. It's like, wow, this is Web 2.0, guys! You know, so much progress has been made since then, which is amazing. And the web developer community in 1999 was this, like, small group of kind of nerds, and today there's millions of web developers, like literally millions. It's crazy how many, and the number of people using the internet in 1999 was like, I don't know, maybe hundreds of thousands or millions, and today it's like half the world, like billions of people connected to this new thing. So it's crazy, like in the course of 20 years, the way people do stuff is completely upended. And so while, you know, we're here at React Conference, people are talking about technology a lot, and sort of sprinkled throughout, I wanted to sort of just reference back to Tim Berners-Lee. I kicked off the talk talking about how, you know, when we travel back in time to 1999, it was 10 years since the paper that described what the World Wide Web could be, which means now today it's the 30-year anniversary.
Wild.
And it's really cool, actually, because you know, Tim Berners-Lee has been connected to the foundations of the web all the way from the beginning through now. Like he still is very much a part of that. And at the 10-year anniversary, he had some really thoughtful words about how we've come so far, his vision for the future. And then he had the same thing earlier this year. He had sort of like another, actually kind of really different look. Like 20 years later from that last speech that he had given, kind of a look back and a look forward. And I pulled some select quotes from both of those moments. And it was fun because like my talk was also about the 10-year point and the 30-year point in the history of the web. And his stuff is not about technology at all. It's like all about what the web does for people and what it does for humanity. And I kind of opened the talk and closed the talk both with quotes from Tim. And at the beginning, it's sort of like looking ahead with optimism of, hey, we've kind of proven the technology, we've done some cool things, but here's what I want it to be. Like, I want it to be this place where people can feel like they belong and where we can do stuff and we can work together. And at the 30-year point, it was sort of saying that had happened. Yeah, like, we did it. Like, it's everything now. It's the library is the internet, and the office place is the internet, and the cinema is the internet, and like everything is the internet. And if that's the case, then like now you have to worry about this whole new set of problems of inclusion and diversity and coverage. And what does it mean if only half of the human population is connected to this thing for the other half that aren't? If now all these like critical parts of how we operate with each other are inextricably tied to the web, which is such a cool sort of look. Like I can't wait to see what 10 or 20 years from even now looks like, because the momentum, like the train continues to accelerate. So it's only has to look completely wildly different.
I love that vision, because you know, now that people are connected in such a different way than they were before, those themes do come up, and we see that, like, we're in those like pains of the internet phase right now of like, what is it like now that everyone can hear from everyone, like what does that mean, right? Like we're ill-equipped to have those types of conversations and like to hear stories of other people's perspectives that we're like, I'd never heard this perspective before, and so it can't be true, but is it, because they sound kind of like me, I guess. And it's, there's a lot of confusion, I think, and like the internet really birthed that. And so it's interesting to hear that like Tim kind of sees that as the, Tim Berners-Lee sees that as the thing we need to solve next, is more of a community problem.
Oh, definitely. Yeah, it's, you know, technology got us here, and there's immense value from where we've gotten so far. But it's also like just really clear what new problems it's introduced. And I think, well, like one of my favorite things is, you know, one of the really early principles that you know, were actually part of the original paper and like actually date back even earlier than Tim and the internet, was this idea that computing is a tool. And so while you can use someone else's tool for yourself and do something, you should be able to make your own tools. And this idea that you could have sort of a, like a read-write internet, you know, like where you can consume stuff in just the same way that you can produce stuff, has kind of played out that way, but in many ways has not played out that way.
Right.
Where, you know, you look at some success cases, like I think YouTube is an amazing success case where you have all these people creating content and they have this platform for doing that that just like didn't exist 10 years ago. And Facebook and Twitter are other good examples of this, where people literally have created platforms for new voices. Like there's people that otherwise would never have been heard from before if it weren't for, you know, Reddit and Twitter and Facebook and these kind of platforms. But at the same time, if you were to build something like Reddit or build something like YouTube, you have to like have a company and hundreds of people and infrastructure that costs millions of dollars a year to build. And is that the right pattern? Like, is that the right way to do this? And, you know, kind of going back in time again, like going back to the 90s, the cool thing was like making your own personal homepage.
I remember
in like the late 90s and the early 2000s, and I was in school and my friends and I were all figuring this stuff out, and there were plenty of free ways to do it. There was GeoCities and there was like other things like that, but you could also, as soon as we realized, like as soon as we got our heads wrapped around buying a domain name, it's like, oh yeah, yo, I got LeeByron.com. We're like, what? How did you do that? And I was like, and I put up like the crappiest website and it cost me like $9 a month to like keep live. And like, it was amazing. Like here I was like a teenager basically, you know, putting together a website. Like anyone could come here, like anyone in the world could see this homepage that I made. And it was awesome. And you know, I see like MySpace as like an intermediate point in that, where people could make their profiles, and there's a super cool feature of MySpace where you could write your own CSS.
Yes.
And you could like hack your MySpace up by like blowing it up. And you know, people would copy and paste their stuff. Yeah. But there's this idea
and
of the, like
put it into some weird field, right? Like some field that you weren't using for your profile.
Yeah.
And it would just hijack all the styles for
exactly.
Yeah.
And but there's this idea of this like read write internet where I could go to your MySpace and like look at your CSS because I thought like, oh man, this, yeah, you got the coolest background image on your mind. Like, I want to know what's up with that. I want to copy that. And I could copy it. And while I did that, I can like see the structure. And when that might have been my first encounter with anything programming-esque, but I see red. And I'm like, I know the word red. I know what that means.
Yeah.
What happens if I type blue? It's blue. Whoa. And you have this like moment where you realize that the like pixels on the screen and the CPU behind it and all this stuff, you're like, I can do anything. I can type yellow. And it's like, and then the page changes color. And it's this amazing moment. And if you think about it, it's like, okay, GeoCities, it's gone. Yeah. MySpace, basically gone. Like the thing that's there now is like not anything like what it was. Like Facebook, but like Facebook, their selling point was like, hey, what if you could actually surf around and not be bombarded with like crazy colors and background images? And be like, oh yeah, please, please God save me from like Lee and Michael's like insane CSS style sheets. And that actually caught on. But I feel like we've lost something in the process.
Yes.
About this idea of being able to like read write web and having control over it and like having your slice and be able to do whatever you want with it and making something real that like people can use and interact with and like share stuff. And I don't know, I feel like you shouldn't have to have a like a CS degree and a venture capital raised round to like do that.
Do you feel like there's kind of a resurgence of not so much that era, but like the artifacts of that era? Like, so right now you're wearing like a little like sweatshirt that says internet and it has the surfer kid with the keyboard on it and the Velcros.
A first discovery book. Yeah. Yeah. This is the cover of a book. I have this book. Yeah. And it's a great book.
But you see, we've been seeing a lot of this like GIFs are coming back in a big way, or you know, GIFs as someone else that I interviewed today said it. You know, we have this. There's this kind of like maybe brutalist type of theming coming back to like certain applications and like personal sites,
and it's like the vaporwave aesthetic.
Yes,
like CD-ROMs and
absolutely, yeah. And like it feels almost like we're kind of like reaching back for parts of that internet that were really meaningful to us, even if like the nostalgia is borrowed, right?
People
like,
really a lot miss of young people. The like rotating under construction GIF. How else am I going to tell people that I'm never going to get back to this?
Absolutely. So one thing that you brought up in your talk that I wanted to touch on, because I think so many people don't, I heard a lot of oohs and ahs, and I've heard this story before, but it was amazing to me that people hadn't. In that transition from like PHP application to like kind of React as we know it now at Facebook, there was this thing that you created in PHP called XHP. And that is kind of where this like notion of like of, you know, the React create element like JSX thing came from. And you talk about how when you shared this idea with the world, everyone was kind of shocked at how much people hated JSX, because y'all loved XHP and that felt like the obvious part of like what you were doing. So tell me a little bit about that.
Yeah, I mean, it's one of those things where we forget like, you know, when you have, you're like, I love this idea.
Yeah.
You forget that like a year or two earlier, you either didn't know about that idea or you hated that idea. Like people change their minds all the time. And so when React was first open sourced, React and JSX came as like a package deal when we talked about it. And that's because of how it had sort of been assembled at Facebook. But React, the library before it was open sourced, did not have JSX. It was just a JavaScript library. There was no JSX there. The author, like, it was not even like on his radar that you could change the syntax of the language. Like, that's kind of a crazy thing to try. But the only reason why JSX was created was that Facebook had created this technology, XHP, that came out of this crazy harebrained project to like rebuild a new version of Facebook from scratch, which is basically just like a cool technical exercise that yielded actually a lot of really excellent technical ideas that later went on to power really important things at Facebook. But this idea of XHP was, okay, PHP is a template language. You used to just kind of write HTML, and then you would put in these little PHP tags and stick your variables there, and you'd get like, you know, data interwoven into your HTML. And that was a really cool idea in 1995 before like security threats were a real thing. But like later we realized like, all right, this is like a bad idea. It doesn't work. And we had to abandon it and go back to like instantiating classes and calling methods on them. And like that was a safer option, but like the code sucked and it was just obvious. And we were looking back at this and we're like, man, like we missed days where there was just three people hacking on some PHP code and you would just like do the dirty thing. But the code was so readable.
Just
like
concatenating strings.
Yeah. But like you could look at the code and know exactly what was going on.
Yes.
And like the same is true if you look at like these old like, you know, Ruby on Rails apps where they use ERB and you just like you see HTML with the template literals. Like, why is it that we're so attracted to the template language? And it's like because it's easy to read, because it's easy to look at the code really quickly and understand what's going on. So these couple super smart engineers at Facebook, Evan Priestley and Marcel Laverdat, were working on this. It was called the Facebook Lite site. It was like this technical rewrite project. And XHP was one of the things that came out of it. And I actually vividly remember now attending a tech talk, internal tech talk at Facebook, where Marcel was talking about XHP and explaining what it was. And it was like kind of like as the Lite site project was like not going to pan out and they were like rescue boating all the technologies that they had built. So he was explaining XHP and I was looking, I was like, this is crazy. And I was like, asked the question, I was like, you know, raised my hand. It's like, hey, so what's the performance implications of this? You know, it's like, seems like it might have some overhead. And Marcel was like, yeah, it's probably 100 to 1,000 times slower.
Whoa.
And he's like, but you know what? This is the part of assembling a web page that's the fastest. So 1,000 times slower is like maybe a 10 millisecond penalty. Like it doesn't matter.
Sure.
It doesn't matter.
Interesting. Yeah, yeah.
And so it's like I realized that I was going through my own mini moment of this like, this just sounds kind of nuts. Like how do you just straight up change the syntax of your programming language? Like this is crazy. And you know, we were just like throwing out, and like the whole audience for this tech talk was like kind of not digging it. They were like, I don't know, like does this make it so that we can never use the PHP compilers? Like does that have to change? Like people just had a lot of like very skeptical questions.
Yep.
But you know, people kind of like, okay, I guess I can kind of see why this could be good. We started using it, and I think the kicker was really that we had this team at Facebook called UIE, User Interface Engineering, sort of the like precursor to the front-end engineering teams at Facebook. And they just saw XHP and were like, oh, this is like a no-brainer. Yeah. Yes, absolutely, we need this. Because they just spent all this time building up this UI component framework, and like you know, knew a PHP class, and you call these methods.
Yeah.
And it was just obvious that it was just like not great code to look at.
Yeah.
So they took one look at XHP and they had to like kind of crawled through the Lite site code base and looked at what real product code that had been built for this sort of like experimental rebuild of Facebook had looked like. And they're like, oh, wow, this is just so obviously better that once that team grabbed onto it, it's like, okay, the UI engineering team is grabbed onto to XHP. Therefore, everyone just kind of has to follow along. Like they were the tip of the spear. They led the
Interesting.
Effort. And it didn't take long. Like within months, it was obvious that it just like it solved the security problems by escaping stuff in the right way. It created a super clean abstraction where you could just say like, oh yeah, I just want a button component. And you didn't have to think like what's going on under the hood there. And it's like all kinds of stuff. Like it's not a template.
Yeah.
Like
yeah.
It's composing stuff. It's doing like, oh, if that button is in the context of a form, if it's a submit button, then oh, then it's this thing. And it's it's nested under a form, in which case it does like this form action. It's like it just did all that for you. And it was amazing. So fast forwarding then, like when we were working on React and people were assembling this stuff, and Jordan had this like crazy, you know, like JavaScript DSL that he had put together where you could like kind of describe HTML elements. People look at it and it's like, yeah, that's all right. But like, what if we had XHP for JavaScript?
Yeah.
And he was like, I don't know if that's a great idea. And then someone kind of like prototyped it, hacked it up, and it like made one of these like transform thing. The first version was like regular expression based. It kind of didn't work.
Oh,
and then,
wow.
And then like later someone made like a decent good one that was like actually, you know, like a parser and made an AST, did a source to source transform and everything. And it was working pretty well. We're starting to write React code with JSX. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Yeah. You had to have that moment twice. Once with XHP,
but,
once with React.
But, like, we had already gone through the XHP transition.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
We'd already figured it out. So, at that point, it's just like, I don't want to give it up.
Yeah.
I'm writing all my UI code in PHP, and it's awesome.
Yeah.
I love it. Like, I feel like most people who really hate PHP, it's because... You know, like a friend of theirs is like, hey, I've got my WordPress site. And I'm like bumping into saying, like, you're a programmer. Can you like help me out real quick? And you're like, yeah, sure. And you hop in, you're like, oh my God, what did I sign up for? This is a disaster.
Yes.
That is not what our code base looked like at all. Like it was complete, like if you looked at 2010 era Facebook PHP and 2010 era WordPress, completely different planets. Because, you know, people had used that stuff before, and they're like, what if we owned our code base and evolved it, and like, what if we forked the language? And we were taking some pretty bold steps in the direction of completely owning our engineering infrastructure, and it showed. Like, we could do this crazy stuff. So when we open source React, and people saw React, and like, yeah, React seems interesting. Like, I don't know if it's like different than Backbone or Angular. Yep. It's like, oh, yet another JavaScript framework. Then they saw JSX, and like, what is this?
Yeah. I don't know enough, but I know enough to be angry about whatever that thing is.
It was like a mix of the people who had been around the block enough time. They had been bitten before. These people don't know what a giant disaster like XSLT was, and it's like, oh, this reminds me of this like framework that we use in this like 15-year-old technology that was just a tire fire.
And JavaScript frameworks were a nightmare at that phase, right? And it's like everyone thought that they had like the solution to everything, and it was all lies.
Everybody already sort of distrusted JavaScript by default because it was like a known hard space to do anything reasonably good in.
Yeah,
and then you had all these new people who. Looked at it and thought, like, HTML in my JavaScripts, you know, and well, what about separation of concerns? It's like, yeah, okay. I hear you, but, like, just try it, please. So it took a moment for people to, you know, there was this very small group of people who were like, this is great. I see it. I used it for a side project. I'm sold. And then the rest of the community kind of needed some time to digest that, needed some time to compare it and contrast it to other stuff, needed to let some other people who are willing to take some risks dive into it, pop back out and be like, hey, guys, the water's warm. It's all right. Like, you can try it. We built our crazy startup and we didn't go under. So I think you need that. Like, any new technology always sorts of needs those early people who can be the like test subjects.
Yeah, absolutely. So you're at Facebook and you have, you know, you're in this culture where you're like, you have all these wild ideas, and there's a lot of things that came out of, I guess, this like later phase, you know, when you're doing a lot more in JavaScript. And one of those is GraphQL. And you have a documentary for GraphQL now.
Yeah, that's pretty wild.
How was that process for you? Was that fun or was it weird? Like, did it come up out of the blue?
Assembling the documentary? Yeah, there's this amazing team at Honeypot. So they essentially run like a, I don't know, it's kind of similar to LinkedIn. They're a recruiting platform. And there's this small team within them that are responsible for sort of like, you know, drumming up attention. And,
interesting.
And creating sort of like an inbound marketing campaigns. Yeah. And they're like, so we can do all kinds of crazy stuff? And you know, one of them is a filmmaker, and they're like, well, what if we made documentaries about the technologies that we like? And so they did this with like a handful of technologies.
I think I might have watched three. There was one for GraphQL, one for, I think, like Elixir? Or...
Yeah, they did Elixir. Super great.
And Ember?
Yep, and Ember.
Yeah.
So I got it. An email. They're based in Berlin, and you know, we had gone to the very first GraphQL Europe conference, which was hosted by our friends at Prisma, who are excellent members of the GraphQL community. Yeah. And they had sort of, you know, Honeypot had helped put on the conference because they're like,
oh wow, cool.
You know, like, oh, this is, we're gonna, drum up energy. It's like the same sort of people, right? Like, oh, this is a great way to tie our name to something that's up and coming. And so I was introduced to these folks at Honeypot. They're like, we want to make a documentary about GraphQL. I was like, are you sure? is someone going to want to watch that? And they're like, well, we just wrapped up this one for Ember. You should take a look at it. And if you think it's good, let us know, because we'd be super excited to do that. And so I watched the one they did for Ember, and I was really blown away. Like, yeah. They did an amazing job, yeah. And they, like, dug into the origin story and a little bit of its progress, and they like, had some footage from the EmberConf, and this is awesome. Like, if they mm-hmm. can do something that quality for GraphQL, like, absolutely. It's worth any amount of time that I can invest in doing that. That'd be a lot of fun. I think they knocked it out of the park. It's amazing. Like, they clearly took a bunch of lessons learned from those previous ones and made something that I'm certainly proud of. I mm-hmm. certainly hope that they're proud of it, because it's truly phenomenal. And I feel like I didn't really truly appreciate the momentum and the progress and the story. Like, they told the story in a way that I felt like I could never have told myself, which is, like, such a gift. Yeah. Yeah.
What's interesting in all of the ones that I watched, something that they seem to capture is just how close these things could have been to have never being.
Yeah.
And I, like, it's particularly in the Ember one, right, where they just talk about, like, how difficult it was to be, you know, a framework that was, like, totally community driven, mm-hmm. right? And in yours, talking about that, what you open source was like a document at first. Right. Like, this is like the specification of the way we kind of see this thing working.
People thought I was nuts when I was like, yeah, let's write a specification. And they're like, what are you smoking? Like, nobody will care about a technical document. And it's like, but I don't know. There's just as much of a chance that I was wrong. I feel like there are many moments in GraphQL's early life cycle where it could have just completely fallen apart.
Yeah.
The first was actually just like the origins of the project. Like, mm-hmm. Facebook was in this very weird time where mm-hmm. there was this momentous move to mobile devices that really Facebook was late to. Like, they did not see it coming at quite the velocity and acceleration that it came. And they found themselves in this position where they wanted to IPO. Mm-hmm. The number one risk was going to be, we're a web app, and like, people are abandoning the desktop web in favor of mobile devices.
Yeah.
And we don't know what we're doing on mobile devices yet. And
when it's weird to think now of like Facebook not having a mobile strategy.
It's totally, yeah. Like, when, you know, I was at Facebook for a really long time, and people are like, what was your first job at Facebook? I was the designer for mobile. Yeah, like the designer for all of mobile. There were 10 of us on the mobile team. Like, it was a skunkworks effort. Like, it was not a thing that the company took seriously as like a holistic part of their strategy.
Yeah.
It was like a growth effort. And it really, like, it whiplashed around. It completely changed the culture of the company in a very short window of time.
Yeah.
And it was scary. Like, people did not know, like, that kind of change, you know, like a complete shift in how people use a technology mm-hmm. has killed companies in the past.
Yeah. Right?
Like, if you think about the shift from film to digital, mm-hmm. there are camera companies gone.
Yeah.
That did not ride that wave, right?
Or even Microsoft and, like, you know, with mobile.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, like, that's a perfect example of a company that missed the mobile wave.
What's so sad is they got actually one of the earliest starts, too.
Right.
Like, Windows mobile stuff was, like, actually really early on. And there's, like, terrible, tiny, like, crappy devices. And they're like, oh, yeah, mobile is, like, this thing that kind of doesn't work very well. And then when the iPhone and the first Android devices came out, they're like, oh, no. It can be good.
Oh,
we got to play catch up real fast. So we were in a very similar position where we were now trying to catch that. And put yourself in the position of an engineering director or a product director or an engineering manager where people are freaking out. It's unclear if the company is going to survive a shift like this. What are you going to do?
Mm-hmm.
I feel like if I was in that position, it would have been really convenient to say, figure out something that's worked before. What are other companies doing that works? Find the safest path out of this mess.
Yep.
And that is not what we did. That is not what we did. We were like, what if you redesign the entire concept of APIs? And they're like, and God bless my engineering director at the time, who was like, that is a cool idea. And he just like created space for us and let us run wild. And like, not totally wild. Like we were up all night, and there's like multiple all-nighters, and we were burning through weekends. Not because we were being told like, you got to meet this deadline. It's like, we were in it. Like, when you've bitten onto something that you're like, this is awesome. Mm-hmm. I can't stop. And we like to, like the three of us that started it, like to say relationships were made and lost, because like the three of us have become like lifelong best buddies as a result of that experience. And then also like, one of our teammates like had to break up with his girlfriend because like she was upset that he had been spending so much time at work. And he's like, what do I pick? My girlfriend or GraphQL? It's like, not a great situation. But, but just to like kind of paint a picture of just the kind of early intensity around this project. But it was kind of what, like, what a crazy move. Like, it was super risky. We could have just been nuts and it wouldn't have worked at all, and we would have been back at square one, but had been like, you know, months behind where we could have been.
We went on this thing and now we're just gonna implement a REST API.
it totally could have turned out that way. But you know, the iOS engineers who are on this like Skunkworks team that was rebuilding our iOS app were using the early versions, the prototypes of this thing that we were building, and we're like just so excited. Like, whoa, this solves a ton of problems that we had before. And then as soon as the schema introspection piece landed as a later part of the prototypes, they were like, oh, we could start to co-generate all the stuff that we hate writing by hand. And it's like, there's like lots and lots of really, really cool ideas that all happened in the early genesis of that, that made it pretty clear that we were onto something that was worth doing. So that was great. I felt like that was a moment that was totally make or break. It could have been something that fell apart. And then the open sourcing was another story. I mean, I think for a long time, at least I personally thought, and I think a lot of my teammates shared this idea that GraphQL was kind of complicated.
Yeah.
And that's kind of because Facebook's data set was complicated, mm-hmm. and the product was complicated, and most products are not that complicated. Yeah. And like, you probably don't need GraphQL. Like, a REST API is probably fine. Mm-hmm. And so I just kind of thought that this was a very Facebook-specific technology. The implementation that we had built was very tightly tied into some of the other abstractions underneath it. And I don't know, it just didn't really seem like a clear case for open source. But we were really pushed. So the React had open source, and that had, you know, despite the early bumpy start, it was proving to be a pretty amazing success.
Yeah.
The Relay team was watching what was happening with React open source, and like, this is amazing. Like, we got open source we're working on. This is great. So they're like, well, what does it mean to open source Relay if GraphQL isn't open source? So they came to us like, hey, would you guys ever consider open sourcing GraphQL? And they're like, we could maybe do that, but what would that even look like? And so we started like talking it through with the team. And my teammate was aggressively trying to convince me to like find the shortest path to open source, like factor away the Facebook specific abstraction, find a way to like slice them, take this blob of PHP code, open source it, write some documentation, mm-hmm. create some energy around that. And, it was right around the time when, like, Node.js was, like, clearly catching steam. Yep. We were kind of catching some flack for PHP. Like, I remember being in interviews with candidates who were considering joining Facebook and, like, you mean I'd have to write PHP code for my day job? I don't know about that. So it's like, okay, I'm thinking.
You're like, well, it's hack, but yeah.
Yeah, yeah, that was before hack.
Oh, really?
That was before hack. But so, you know, I was looking at the success of the React project, and I was thinking, like, a huge reason why it's successful is because JavaScript. Like, JavaScript was on this tear, and PHP really was not. So I just didn't see a path where a PHP library would get this traction. And so that was kind of the inspiration for like, all right, well, what does it look like then? And so I kind of pitched, well, what if we rewrote it in JavaScript? Like, well, we don't like run JavaScript on the server at Facebook. So like, what would that even mean? And I was like, well, kind of think about it as a like a first principles rewrite. Like if we were to rewrite GraphQL from scratch.
Interesting.
And we sort of like did that, and then we compared it to our PHP implementation, then we could start to look at stuff like, oh yeah, why did we implement it that way? Is that a quirk from, you know, multiple years of evolving this thing over time, or was that intentional, or what is this thing exactly? And having two implementations sort of forced us to start to think through some of those decisions, which yielded this like pretty amazing like reinvigoration of the design process where like we actually made pretty substantial changes to GraphQL during this window of time and figured out how we'd factor them back into how GraphQL at Facebook worked. And along the way we were documenting it, and I was like, this should just be a formal spec, you know, like this should just crisply describe what it is. And because part of the reason was I was really nervous that, you know, it's one thing to open source a PHP library and for it not to catch on. But also, like, yeah, Node was becoming a thing. But there was also, like, this whole discussion about, is Node on the server a fad? Like, there are all these problems people were bumping into. Yep. And I really didn't want GraphQL to get tangled up in that mess.
Sure.
Where people thought, like, this is just a JavaScript thing, and JavaScript on the server is this, like, newfangled fad, and, like, real engineering companies don't do that. They all use, whatever, Scala or Python or Ruby or whatever. And I felt like it would have been a huge miss to miss out on all of those communities as well. And so that was, sort of like, the energy behind writing the spec. And when we first presented it, I presented it at a React conference, which, like, in hindsight, like, helped propel us forward. Mm-hmm. It created some early momentum, but also, I don't know, it made this early association with React that was somewhat warranted because Relay came later, but also like the original purpose of GraphQL was to, you know, boost up these mobile products. Like that was the origin story, it was mobile. But luckily, like I'm so glad that we wrote the spec. And so glad that our announcement of it was like, please look at the spec, look at our reference implementation, and if you use a different language, build this. Build this for your language. And it was crazy. Like within months, we had almost a dozen implementations.
Well, I remember I was sitting right next to a coworker then, Robert Masalgo, who was maintaining React Rails at the time. And immediately, like we were sitting there watching y'all announce this. And immediately he registered, was it Ruby GraphQL or whatever?
GraphQL Ruby.
GraphQL Ruby on
it's like, there's
on
no code
Ruby
here
gems.
Yet, but I'll fill that part in later. Yeah.
Exactly. Like immediately, like totally caught the vision. He was like, I'm going to do the Ruby one. And
he did.
Yeah, he did. Yeah. And I imagine that that was kind of a similar story for other people in like, you know, different languages who were like, I want to be the one who like did the thing.
It's awesome. It's like that early set of people. Almost none of them had a business interest in doing this.
Yeah.
Right. They were just impassioned people who like caught the bug. They saw it and they're like, I get it. Like, I know, I see that. Yes, that problem has bitten me before. I want to help. And they started doing this as like a hobby project.
Yeah.
And that's like looking back at how React first launched. That's also how people were using React. There was no business that like the day after the JS Conf talk where they announced React, they were like, "Yep, we're gonna transition everything to React." No, it was like crazy people doing side projects, like playing with this thing, and then slowly you like build up the chain until you get to the point where like real companies are doing stuff. And then that's exactly what happened with GraphQL. You got these early people who jumped in. They're like, write an API parser and compiler in my language of choice. Like, cool. Sounds like weekends were well spent. It was great. It like bootstrapped an extremely healthy beginning of a community of this group of people who came from all different like technical backgrounds who all kind of shared this problem that they wanted to help solve. And that just like created the solid foundation for then later, you know, startups and then companies and then big companies and then like Fortune 100s that use GraphQL, which is, it's been extremely humbling to watch that progress.
Yeah, I was talking with Chris Toomey at Thoughtbot, and he said it better than I think anyone else I've heard up to that point, but he's just saying that using GraphQL allows them to get closer to product. right? And so like when they're working with a company to design a product, it takes out so many layers of the classic development cycle where it's like, you know, you throw it to the API team and they like kind of fester over how they're going to like get this data in the right places. And then they finally like, you know, release an endpoint and then you build up around that endpoint or whatever. And it's just like there's now this bridge, right? GraphQL is a bridge between those two teams.
Right.
And it's a thing that I feel like we didn't even know that we needed until you showed us. How does it feel to come back to React Conf, you know, 5 years later and, you know, have them lead with, you know, the next Facebook, like the desktop one, like not the mobile one, is now bringing back all of these technologies that you've designed and pioneered, you know, five, six, 7 years ago?
It's amazing. I mean, it feels like... one of the last chapters of that particular piece of the Facebook mm-hmm. product, working through that, you know, because the mobile clients went through that evolution 5 years ago,
yep.
where they were originally built with mobile web technology, and you know, my team was the one that started to boot up that original technology, and then it like famously didn't work at all, and it's like we made a terrible bet that didn't play out. And we rebuilt those applications from scratch, and they had that opportunity to sort of, you know, reimagine what their foundation should look like, and the Facebook website really hasn't. It's evolved in place, which isn't a bad thing. Like, you know, they've made serious massive leaps forward, while never going down. You know, there's never like closed for maintenance on Facebook.com, right?
You never see those spinner GIFs.
It just keeps getting better and better. And this is the first time, maybe since that light site project of 2009, that they started over. They're like, what if we were to do this from scratch? How would we do it? Knowing all the problems that we'd bump into, knowing all the constraints that we have, knowing the scale problems that we have, what would we try? And like, you gotta have respect for that bold bet, you know. Like, it still might not work, I certainly hope it does. And it's amazing because you see, you know, all these technologies start to interweave together to create like a cohesive technical platform on which to build this stuff, and they've filled in a ton of the cracks. There's a lot of super interesting new ideas and technologies that are falling out of that particular effort. But it kind of brings it all the way back to what a lot of the people in the open source or other technical communities are doing with React. Like, you know, the React server-side rendering implementation was originally not written by Facebookers because, like, Facebook does, like, their didn't server-side rendering is PHP. They didn't do that. And so this whole concept of, like, React existing outside of the context of just a dynamic interactable element on the client is something that the community's been working on for years.
Yeah.
And it's actually like really exciting now that Facebook, with all of their super smart engineers, is going after exactly that set of problems, because you just know that they're going to bump into a bunch of super interesting problems and ideas that are going to yield the next couple of years of advancements to what we all do.
That's one thing I'm really excited about with all of this new stuff happening in React. I know that it's hard to be patient, like when we've seen kind of some of the ideas proposed, like, you know, years or a year and a half ago, right? Yeah. But you know that like it's taking time because those kinks are being worked out, the things that people would end up having to figure out on their own, and that by the time that it comes, it's going to be a really good product. So you spent all this time at Facebook doing engineering and inventing stuff, and I think just last year, has it been about a year that now that you've left Facebook?
Year and a half, coming on 2 years relatively soon that I've been out. Yeah.
And you've moved to Robinhood.
Yeah.
So tell me about that transition. How has it been?
It's been really exciting. So Robinhood is a financial services company. We're democratizing access to our financial system, and it's a relatively small company. You know, it's still a startup. It's not a tiny startup. It's it's a medium sized startup now, but it's at this moment in its growth that's just super fun to be at, to be a part of. Where when I joined a little over a year and a half ago, the company was a couple hundred total and less than 100 people within engineering. Okay. And now we're like over 600 people total.
Oh, wow.
And like well over 200 people in engineering. So it's grown a lot. And, you know, when I first started at Facebook, it was ballpark similar size.
About the same.
Like maybe 400 people total and 150 engineering when I first started at Facebook. And at the time, I just like didn't really know what I was looking at. Yeah. You know, like I was not that far out of school. I hadn't really had that many jobs before. It was my first time in Silicon Valley. And I just didn't really appreciate that hyper growth and the problems that were falling out of that were getting pretty interesting solutions. And instead, I just only with the benefit of hindsight did I realize that I kind of missed that.
Yeah.
You know, I really missed that. Like my most favorite window of time of my career at Facebook was like 2009 to 2012. This like window of just the company just exploding in growth and just like bumping into new problems left and right. None of which had any clear solution. There's like no playbook on how to do these things.
Yeah.
Both technical problems, product problems, people problems, and just like being in the thick of it was like, to be fair, stressful. Like it was a lot, but also like really fun. And mm-hmm. you know, I still got to work on lots of awesome stuff at Facebook throughout the years. And then in my later years at Facebook, I got to work on the GraphQL open sourcing effort and do that. I got to work on Relay. I got to work on a lot of other projects that I'm super proud of, but I just really missed that time where you were going to launch a big new product and you would do it with like three new grads, you know, and they would come up with some like harebrained scheme on how to like technically pull it off. And everyone else was so busy building their own thing that they're like, yeah, it's probably fine.
Sure,
like,
sure,
I'm sure.
Sure
it'll work. And it did because, you know, when you take someone who's like smart and you throw them in the deep end, they typically figure out how to float and they teach themselves stuff and they grapple. It's not that they're coming with bad ideas. No, of course not. They're actually doing the opposite. They have no dogma. They have no prior conception of what the right way is to do it. So they're like, oh, this is an interesting problem. What if we did it this way? And then so you back up and you're like, that's like where XHP came from. That was from a person who was at the very beginning of his career. And like a lot of these ideas. And in my talk, I talked about Gen XHP, which was this pairing of XHP as a way to define concepts with asynchronous functions, you know, asynchronous data loading.
Yeah.
And I kind of glossed over how, like, oh yeah, later we tie these things together. No, there was a diff, a PR that went up that had weeks, like 6 weeks of back and forth comment, like hundreds and hundreds of comments on this diff, this PR from like a bunch of senior engineers across the company. The author of the diff, by the way, an intern. It's at the end of his internship and he just like had this moment where he's like, wow, well, what I like, this component needs this like newsfeed data and that component needs this notification data. It's like, why do we have to write the data fetching logic in a separate file? Like, are we sure this makes sense? And he wrote it and people are like, no, never, we gotta make sure this never, this is a terrible idea. And it's like, and he'd be like super patient. He'd be like, why? Can you help me understand why it's a bad idea? And they're like, well, separation of concerns. Oh, well, you can get this cache invalidation. It's like, oh, and he would like carefully and slowly explain why that particular problem can be solved or was solved. He'd be like, oh, interesting. Let me iterate on that. And the diff would get better and better. And eventually he just like tired everyone out. They're like, all right, let's try it. And it totally revolutionized the code. Like, it.
Unbelievable.
Within months. It was everywhere, and it was how we built stuff. So, like, the idea where you, like, throw in a small team of people with a bunch of people who are smart and, like, ready to come up with crazy new ideas, it's an electric environment.
Yeah.
So, I was really just looking for something like that again. And it was clear to me that Robinhood was right about to enter that phase.
Yeah.
And like their web engineering team had two people. and they're like, these two people both of which were recently out of school, had built this like web application that was beautiful. The design was awesome. The interactions were great. Yeah. I was like, you two did this? And they're like, yeah, that's really impressive.
Like, that's where I want to be again.
Yeah, that's awesome. And like, likewise, the iOS team was small and the Android team was small and the backend team was small. Mm-hmm. And I would talk to all these people there and they were like clearly just lit up about how this time next year we're going to have all this more stuff. And then after that, we're going to do even more stuff. And it was like, oh yeah, okay. You guys are about to like double in size and double in size again. And like, and it, hopefully, you know, hopefully like this is, you're about to buy into this whole set of problems that I just did that like 10 years ago. And I'm remembering now how much I missed that.
Yeah.
And so it lit me up. I was like super excited about it. And, you know, my longtime manager at Facebook, Adam Wolf, was like going through the same thing at the same time and also found himself at Robinhood.
Awesome.
And like, this was like validation for both of us. I started at Robinhood, I think, the like one of the last times that Adam came through for his part of his interviews, and he didn't know that I was joining Robin. So he like saw me, I think it was my second day at the company, and he was like walking around with his like visitor lanyard, and he's like pointed at me. He's like, hey, walked over. He's like, so everything good so far? I was like, yeah, man, this is exciting. I'm working on cool stuff. He's like, okay, good to hear the water's warm. So like now we're working together again, which is a blast because Adam and I have gotten to work on so many cool things over the, he was at Facebook for 7 years as well. Like in a lot of that time we got to work together. So it's been super exciting. And, you know, I am extremely lucky to have gotten to help build a web engineering team full of really, really smart people with all kinds of backgrounds and things that they built before. Mm-hmm. And so now we're like more than a dozen web engineers and we all get to work on really cool stuff. So it's
awesome.
It's really, really fun. Yeah.
That sounds amazing. Are you guys hiring right now?
Should we tell
people to go there and check out Robinhood?
Yeah, we've got a jobs page. We keep growing. We're constantly in the state. We're like, oh, if only we had one more person. It's like, all right, we found that as quickly as we've grown as a product engineering team, and I'm really excited about you know, our step forwards and all the problems and building new teams. You know, it's lots of stuff falls out of that. And our ambition just scales as fast as we can grow. Like it always
seems to be one step ahead.
Oh my God. Like we go from 2 web engineers to 12 web engineers and like somehow we go from like one project to 6 projects and it's okay. And they're like, which of these projects is most important? Like they're all extremely strategically important. Like where's the next web engineer going to come from? Cause we need them to get started on this project. And it's just exciting. Like that's the kind of environment that's just really fun to be in. And,
absolutely.
You know, like what does it look like to boot up a specialist interview pipeline? It's like, oh, I got to do that at Facebook and oh, cool. I get to do it again. And it's like, oh, we're bumping into this problem. It's like, oh, well actually we tried something at Facebook. It didn't work so well. So let's try something different
Time. Yeah, yeah.
So it's just really fun that like now that I'm back in that position, I get to actually leverage back knowledge of doing at least something semi-related before.
Nice. Well, hey, I don't want to hold you too long, but I do want to ask, how is everything going with the GraphQL Foundation and how has been setting that up and you know, directing it been?
Yeah, well, man, that's been a delight. I mean, the fact that GraphQL has grown to the scale that it has is already extremely humbling. And I just have it's kind of my baby, you know.
Yeah.
I'm not the only person responsible for it. There's a bunch of us that worked on it, but I was really the linchpin of the open source process, and I've just felt this responsibility for making sure that it has the healthiest path into the future. And when I was leaving Facebook, I was really nervous that, you know, I within Facebook, I could tell that I was the one making sure that this relationship to the open source GraphQL community remained healthy. And once I left Facebook, I was a little bit nervous that just wouldn't have the same attention after I left. So I started to talk to people that I respected in, you know, the Node.js Foundation, JavaScript Foundation, the TC39 folks. I'm deeply connected into all that JavaScript ecosystem and trying to figure out like how does this work? Like how do you take a project that's booted up by a company, and like when the person who's kind of making sure the open source stuff works leaves, like then what? And I heard a lot, I got a ton of feedback from that, but one of the things I heard was like, Lee, what if you want to go do something else? GraphQL is big and important, and like you need to set something up so that it can be sustainable. And I got connected to someone at the Linux Foundation who, and like this is basically what the Linux Foundation does. Mm-hmm. They kind of build themselves as foundation as a service because they just got really good at it. Like it started as just Linux, and they had the foundation around Linux, and Linux is a beast. So like you need a lot of resources to keep that whole thing running. And there's just all these like other projects that were tangentially related to Linux. So they're like, oh yeah, I guess we could do that too. And then they built up all this expertise in open source law and the like technical process management of actually running these committees and like governance and fundraising and just like all the stuff that you need to make these things healthy. Mm-hmm. They just like have done that for a bunch of things. So we booted up the GraphQL Foundation in partnership with the Linux Foundation so we could leverage all of their knowledge and some of their resources, and got a bunch of these companies that have been using GraphQL for a long time, or bigger companies that are using GraphQL as part of their core infrastructure and want to participate in its evolution, and just started this like consortium of super smart people that have been doing this. And basically what it is assembling structure to the stuff that we were already doing.
Awesome.
Right? And it's been awesome. It's been awesome. So now we have, I think, over 20 members of the foundation and growing. So like if your company uses GraphQL, we want to hear from you, especially if you want to be part of its future, where we expect to continue to grow. You know, the foundation officially booted up in like February of this year, so it's still relatively new. It takes some time to bootstrap these things, so we're still kind of in the process of getting all the pieces assembled. But it's been great. There's already a bunch of people outside of just me that are taking on big meaty projects in the like GraphQL maintenance space.
Oh, great!
Which is great. So like it's in a much more sustainable position.
Where do people find out more about the foundation for GraphQL?
Yeah, they can check out foundation.graphql.org, which is sort of our front page for the foundation. That gives a good overview of sort of what it's about and what we're up to. But then we also, like, we just do everything through GitHub, which is kind of great. Yeah, so if you go to github.com/GraphQL, you will find not only technical projects, like the GraphQL spec is there, GraphQL.js, Graphical, the IDE is there, but you'll actually also find all of our foundation process.
Amazing.
So there's the github.com/GraphQL/foundation, which has all of our legal documents and covenants and governance documents, which we just maintain as like markdown files that we can export to PDFs when we need to. There's our GraphQL working group, GraphQL-WG. So we keep like agendas and notes. And so it's like just kind of everything lives in GitHub there, which is awesome for discoverability. It's awesome for maintenance. Like we don't have to leverage just me or just like a project manager to keep that stuff afloat. We can leverage exactly the same tools we use for project and code management, but like for foundation and community management, which is cool. Like I actually don't know how many projects operate that way.
Yeah.
So we're kind of trying to test out these tools and see how they work for community development.
Awesome. Well, Lee, it is always a pleasure. You're kind of at the forefront and in the middle of so many things that we use as modern web developers. Thanks for being on the show.
It's my pleasure.
How can people find you if they you know, want to follow along with what you're doing with GraphQL or kind of make good for a Robinhood application?
Oh yeah, yeah. So you can certainly like find out about me. You can go. My personal homepage is leebyron.com. Held that domain for a really long time. Always interesting stuff there. I'm fairly active on Twitter at leeb. So you can certainly find me there. You know, you can at me. I might at you back. And then, you know, check out robinhood.com. We're up to some cool stuff. Yeah.
Check it out. Awesome. Awesome. Thanks, Lee.
Excellent.
Thanks for listening to this episode of React Podcast. Show notes for this episode are available at reactpodcast.com/77. If you like this show, there's a fast, free way to demonstrate your support. leave us a review on iTunes. It's the best way for you to let me know what you think we're doing right and what we can improve. 2 to 3 minutes of your time helps us make the best show we possibly can. As always, links and show notes for all episodes are available at reactpodcast.com. This episode was edited by Mikhail Delport. It was produced by Mikhail Delport and Sarah Jackson at Spec, a network to help you level up in design and development. Check out spec.fm for other shows that are sure to fast-track your career. I'm your friend Chantastic. Thanks for listening. We'll be in your ears again next week.